Let the Galaxy Burn. Narrated by a Border Prince. Battle of the Archaeosaurs by Barrington J. Bailey. Within its oval frame of enameled copper, the hollow plate displayed the nearly perfect sphere of a planet fringed with cloud and shining seas. Fleet Captain Karlak slapped a knob, causing the image of the world to rotate at a faster rate. The mapping is incomplete, having been carried out from orbit by the first surveyor ship to arrive, Karlak explained. He struck the knob again, making the image halt and then move around in small jerks until a pear-shaped continent became visible. He positioned an arrow in the middle of it. This is where the first landing was made, on the sole inhabited continent. The initial survey had reported a sparse human population which, like many settlements dating from the Dark Age of Technology, had lost the technical arts and degenerated to the Stone Age. As you know, Imperial policy in such circumstances is to land amid the populated areas and take control immediately. A single battalion, lightly armed, was deemed more than sufficient to subdue a primitive people, establish a military base and secure the planet for the Imperium. As you also know by now, it was wiped out almost immediately, without a single survivor. The captain looked around at the guests. They were seated in his private cabin, with its darkly gleaming panelled walls embellished with icons of the Emperor, and its ribbed and curved ceiling, aboard the troop ship he commanded, the Mobilitatum. With 1,000 troops aboard, the Mobilitatum was approaching planet ABL-1034, the planet on the screen, as was its sister ship, the Straterium. Some distance to their rear came two immense travel pods containing warlord titans, the Lex et Annihilato and the Principo Non Tactica, two prime examples of the mightiest land war machines ever to exist. Their commanders, Princeps Garius and Princeps Ephraim, sat across the cabin, men of stern appearance in their diamond-shaped peak caps, skulls stitched into their epaulets. Also present were Imperial Guard Colonels Kostos and Commissar Henderek, both of the 5th Halvatian Regiment. It was most unusual for sealed orders to be entrusted to a fleet captain rather than to an Imperial Guard officer, but security was of the essence. Public morale dictated that as few people as possible should know what had happened on planet ABL-103. A stronger expedition equipped with Lehman-Russ battle tanks and Basilisk mobile support artillery was then dispatched to the same location. It met a similar fate. Messages dispatched to the orbiting transports spoke of giant beasts which the natives were using as battle weapons. Only one brief visual transmission was received. Planet ABL-1034 vanished from the holoplate. A blurred, shaking picture replaced it, showing a huge shape looming over the camera. Colossus-like legs, a vast neck, jaws that could have swallowed the cabin in which the officers watched. Then nothing. The screen went blank. Large animals have been trained for use in battle on many primitive planets, including on ancient Terra, Captain Karlak continued. Such forms of warfare have never presented the least problem to the Imperial Guard. The difference here would appear to be one of size. The Imperium has simply not encountered beasts this huge before. Again, the fleet captain manipulated the knobs in front of the enamel-decorated holoplate. A procession of lumbering creatures crossed the visual area, some with long necks and thick tails. The outline of a man in the corner of the screen gave some idea as to their size, which was much larger than any living Terran animal. Genitals of the Adeptus Mechanicus, by studying fossil records, have established that beasts such as these lived on Earth 100 million years ago. Similar animals are common throughout the galaxy, but are too unmanageable to be trained for war. In any case, they could be downed with a single shot. How even larger beasts are able to be utilized on the planets is a mystery. However, Mechanicus genitals have named them Archaeosaurs because of their resemblance to the ancient Earth animals. Again, the scene on the holoplate changed to show clouds and filaments formed of stars. An arrow picked out the star that warmed planet ABL-1034. The Archaeosaurs planet has a strategic value, as you can see for yourselves. It guards the crossing point between no less than 3 star systems, all of them of interest to the Imperium. It has been ordered that the planet will not be permitted to be lost by default. It must be occupied. That is why 2 Warlord Titans have been assigned to the next landing, so that there may be no question of further defeat. Colonel Kostos coughed softly. While not wishing to criticise command decisions, is it not an overreaction to call on the Adeptus Titanicus in this case? Our 5th Helvation Regiment is battle-hardened, down to less than half its original strength. He made this last statement with pride. Imperial Guard regiments generally dwindled in proportion to their number of engagements they had fought, their final remnants eventually being absorbed elsewhere. A regiment at full strength meant an inexperienced regiment. The second landing was made by elements of the 1st Iaxist, a newly raised regiment that had never seen an engagement before. It is certain the whole affair was carelessly executed. The natives underestimated. It's sometimes a fatal error to suppose that primitive people need not be taken seriously in military terms. I have known men armed with nothing but stone axes to overrun a guard outpost in a sneak attack. Commissar Hendrick nodded in judicious agreement.
Either that, or the 1st Iaxist had not enough faith in the Emperor.
On hearing this, Princeps Garius looked askance at the Commissar, disdain flitting across his face. The Adeptus Titanicus was an ancient order, predating the Ministerium, which promulgated the cult of the Emperor, and it was unique among the Imperium's fighting forces in coming under the Adeptus Mechanicus. Its officers mostly followed the Martian religion, worshipping the Emperor as the machine god and totality of all knowledge. The icons on the bridge of Garius's Titan were quite different from the holy images he saw here. Text sigils and arcane formulae overlaid the Emperor's stern visage. In his eyes, Imperial Guard commissars with their emotional ranting about faith were little short of lunatics. The look on Garius's face did not go unnoticed by Captain Karlach. Surreptitiously, he studied the princeps. He was hook-nosed, a feature common among Titanicus officers, a consequence, no doubt, of the hereditary strain in the Adeptus. Privately, Karlach agreed with Colonel Kostos that the mission was a trivial misuse of such extraordinary machines. He wondered if Garius and Ephraim thought so too. Not that they would ever voice such an opinion. The discipline of Titan officers was legendary. For the first time, Princeps Garius spoke, his voice dry and sardonic.
There is little to go on, it seems. But no matter, we of the Adeptus, at any rate, have little to fear. Let us go down on planet and bring this business to a speedy finish.
Landing a Titan was not a simple matter. This was the time when the monstrous machines were most at risk. On the bridge of Lex et Annihilato, Princeps Garius took the command seat. Beside him were his bridge officers, tactical officer Veridins, weapons moderator Knifesmith, and chief engineer Morians. Down below, sweating with fear, huddled the Titan's 6 ordinary crewmen. Command had been temporarily handed to the 4-man landing and ascent crew of the transport pod, who now were seated before the command podium, which in turn was hooked through to the pod's controls. The coning plate currently showed the view outside the pod. Feet first, the Titan was lowering itself through planet ABL-1034's atmosphere. In the distance, the pod carrying Principo Non Tactica and Princeps Ephraim and his crew could be seen. Heated air flamed around it, turning the pod white hot. The Titans were to be the first to land. The Imperial Guard would arrive under their protection. Using consummate skill to keep the tall pod stable as it fell, the crew steered Lex et Annihilato towards its designated landing place. Deceleration over, they soared over a landscape of mountains, valleys and plains, interspersed with dense forests. It appeared to be a fertile world, Princeps Garius thought. No wonder it had been colonised long ago in the Dark Age of Technology. Now it would become more than just a strategic outpost. He could see it someday becoming a productive agricultural world, perhaps later even a forge world or a hive world. He leaned close to the coning plate, with this thought in his mind, imagining how the landscape would look in the future.
What in the All-Knowing's name is that?
The exclamation was torn from his throat.
Steersman, take us back over that ridge.
The pod's officer leaned back at him nervously.
That will be tricky, Princeps.
Take us back, I say.
Although technically Garrius was not in command of the Titan at this moment, the pod officer dared not defy him. Instead, he muttered to the men on either side of him. Carefully, consulting continually with one another, they eased the pod back over to the other side of the ridge and hovered. Oaths now came involuntarily from the mouths of all Garrius's officers. Five huge hulks lay toppled on their side in a broad fern-clad valley. They must have lain there for centuries, for they were rusting away, dissolving with age, riddled with holes and covered in lichen. Had they been standing, they would not have been as tall as the Warlord Titans, but they were broader, monstrous, rotund shapes. Tactical Officer Veridin's gasped out shocked words.
Orgargans!
It was indeed astonishing to see these mighty machines, the crude orc versions of the Titans, felled and abandoned on a primitive world. Garrius looked thoughtfully on the scene.
It seems the orcs have also tried to take this world at some time in the past.
They were defeated,
weapons moderate knifesman ground out.
It's hardly credible.
Hardly defeated by the natives, Garrius told him confidently. Orcs usually end up fighting amongst themselves. In any case, we have nothing to fear. Whenever a Titan has met a Gargant, the Titan has prevailed. Gargants were best described as caricatures of Titans. In place of power bundles, they were worked by clumsy, clanking beams and cogwheels, and they were steam-driven. In place of fission reactors, banks of furnaces were fed by teams of stokers. But then, no one could build such superb machines as those of the Adeptus Titanicus. They were all thousands of years old, and even though continually repaired and renewed, they still retained the special occult qualities of the Dark Age of technology. The Adeptus Mechanicus had tried to build brand new Titans themselves, but the fruits of their efforts never performed nearly as well.
Enough, Garrius said shortly. On, pilot.
The great pod eased itself back over the ridge. Far in the distance, Garrius saw what looked like a herd of animals, but there was no time now to magnify the image. The slow thunder of the landing engine faded as the pod was lowered gently onto a plain scattered about with overturned artillery, smashed tanks, and flattened drop shuttles. This was where the second expedition had met its grisly fate, and this was where the Imperium would now finally exert its will. Planet ABL-1034 was a low-gravity planet, perfect for the operation of Titans, which originally had been designed for use on Mars. The huge pod opened up and trundled away over the moss. The Lex Et Annihilato was revealed in all its prodigious glory, roughly the shape of a man and the height of a 12-story building, bristling with armament. A kilometre away strode its match, the Principo Non Tactica. Princeps Garrius smiled. Whenever he saw two Titans standing on the same landscape, twinned colossi, he felt an urge to engage in a duel, to have the machine striding towards one another with shoulder cannon blazing. He was sure that his colleague, Princeps Arferim, on the bridge situated within the cranium of the Principo Non Tactica, felt the same. It had never been his luck to engage with a Chaos Titan, possibly the only worthy opponent of the Adeptus. But one day... The landing crew left the bridge. Chief Engineer Morians left too, descending into the body of the Warlord to rally the cowering crewmen. Now the drop shuttles were coming in, Imperial Guard detachments piling out and setting up a perimeter around the watchful Titans. More shuttles landed and disgorged Basilisk artillery, Lehman Russ tanks and Rhino armoured carriers. For the third time, planet ABL-1034 was claimed for the Imperium. For a while, the landing force would merely hold its ground, scanning the terrain from within the craniums of the Warlords, waiting to see if an attack would come. If it did not, the Titans would stride out to seek the Emperor's revenge. Guardsman Leckie and Colour Sergeant Hengist were the last two left in the prisoner cage. In his tattered uniform, Osmin Leckie, smeared with mud and pale of face, stared from between the rough-hewn timbers at the Stone Age village which sprawled all around them. He had always thought of Stone Age humans as shambling and brutish, a picture reinforced by the pre-landing morale lectures, but the people he saw striding among the fern-thatched roofs were nothing like that. They were tall, muscled men, proud of bearing. There were gracious, equally proud women. There were agile, healthy children,
It was he, Osman Leki, who felt like a frightened primitive. By contrast, the natives who should have cowered in fear and awe at contact with the Imperium had shown no fear at all. And no wonder. Far off, the guardsmen could see one of the natives' battle beasts ambling across the horizon. It was like watching a mountain move, a mountain with a long neck, carrying a huge head like a rock outcrop, and an impossibly long and massive tail. From where Leki cowered, the human beings which he knew swarmed over the beast were too small to be visible. He shuddered, remembering the attack which had killed most of his comrades. Colour Sergeant Hengist squatted in a corner of the cage, his head in his hands. One thing was true about the Stone Age primitives, and that was their cruelty. There had been 50 captives in the cave to begin with. The villagers had been killing one per day, always by some different method. Their ingenuity seemed inexhaustible. While the Commissar had been alive, Leki had been able to keep his own spirits up to some extent. The Commissar had exhorted them constantly to keep faith in the Emperor, and he had encouraged them to believe that rescue was possible. The villagers had seemed to be amused by his hectoring, though of course they could not understand it. They had kept him till nearly last. He had been killed the day before. True, it had been inspiring to witness the Commissar's grim fortitude as he was torn apart, limb by limb. Only at the very end did his torturers succeed in wringing cries of agony from him. But the spectacle had finally broken Colour Sergeant Hengist, and it had broken Guardsman Leki too. Leki shivered. He trembled. The Imperium was far away. The Emperor was but a word. He glanced again at the distant Archaeosaur, to use the name given the beasts in the morale lectures. It had turned and was approaching the village. Then, a creaking sound from behind him made him turn. The cage's gate was opening. Bronze-skinned Stone Age men entered. They dragged out the whimpering, sobbing Emperor's guardsmen to face their doom. There was a peculiarity to planet ABL-1034. Cloud formations were all of the same type, a series of evenly spaced ribs or striations high in the sky, stretching from horizon to horizon. No one in the expeditionary force asked himself what produced this phenomenon. That was a task for an adept, and to the military mind, planetary peculiarities were too numerous to be worth thinking about. But as the striped cloud cover raced across the sky, it broke up the light of the hard, white sun and produced a rippling effect on the ground below. Princeps Garius found the rapidly shifting light and shade eerie, but also restful. The expedition had not so far been challenged, and the officers were enjoying a meal in the open air. Artillery and track vehicles grumbled and clanked around them. It was a traditional courtesy for a princeps to eat with the Imperial Guard officers during a combined operation, though both Garius and Ephraim would have preferred to be with the rest of their bridge crews, supervising a meticulous checking of their warlords. Commissar Hendrik was consulting the Imperial Tarot. Reverently, he unfolded the purple velvet cloth in which the deck was wrapped, pushed aside the remains of the meal, and laid out 3 cards to form a triangle, tapping each in turn. The surfaces of the cards glittered and swirled, flashing with colour. The card at the apex of the triangle was the Significator. It was the first to clear and form an image. The Emperor appeared, seated on a throne carved from a single gigantic diamond, glaring out at the beholder. The card on the left was the next to stabilise. It showed universal force, a snake with its tail in its mouth, whirling endlessly against a background of receding galaxies. The final card cleared almost immediately after it to show the galactic realm, producing one of several images by which that card manifested itself. A maiden in a flowing gown stood on a landscape, star formations in the sky at her back, pouring multicoloured liquid from 2 large pitchers she held, one in each hand. The liquid flooded the landscape, carrying away cities and forests. The Commissar banged his fist on the table.
"The meaning is clear," he intoned. "Might will prevail."
"Of course," Princeps Aphorim drawled, glancing casually at the triangle of images. "What else could the cards show if they tell the truth?"
"Yes, what else?" Commissar Hendrik said feverishly. "Though the images contain an ambiguity, one must judge carefully when interpreting the Emperor's tarot. True, the presence of the Emperor as Significator
confirms that the message relates to our current operation. But universal force does not necessarily refer to the forces of the Divine Emperor. Forces opposed to his terribilitas could be implied. Also, the galactic realm.
The Commissar's eyes widened as he redirected his gaze back to the final card. The image was changing, the landscape writhing and rising up around the feet of the maiden, threatening to topple her.
Imperator Divinitas, he gasped in horror. We are undone!
Garius's patience had reached its limit. With a grunt of disgust, he swept the cards from the table.
Enough of your superstitions, faith cultist, he snarled. True holiness is the holiness of the machine. Suggest defeat for our titans on a planet of animals, and you are ripe for reprocessing as a servitor.
Commissar Hendrik leapt to his feet, fury on his face. It was not that he heard the Princeps' words as an insult to himself personally. He heard them as an insult to the Emperor. He made a sudden movement, as if reaching for his las pistol. Colonel Kostos was about to intervene, but excited shouting from the perimeter interrupted the exchange. A veteran sergeant ran up and saluted hastily.
Native warbeasts advancing on the camp, Colonel!
Princeps Garius laughed, sounding like a drain emptying.
Now we see.
Bring the two slaves forward!
The order was barked out by the clan hetman. He stood in the middle of the village compound, wavy blonde hair flowing down his hard-muscled back, a stone axe thrust into his belt of woven fern leaves. Colour Sergeant Hengist and Guardsman Lecky were flung at his feet, where they cringed like dogs peering left and right.
"'Are not warriors!'
the headman roared at the villagers who were gathered around him.
"'These are slaves of the giant shining men, the real warriors who have come again from the sky to do battle with us. That is why the gods gave us the defenders, to help us fight the giant shining warriors.'
Lecky and Hengist could not, of course, understand a syllable of what the hetman was saying. All they understood by this time was that every second they remained alive and untortured was a miracle. At the same time, the knowledge that pain and death was coming closer second by second struck stark fear into their souls. Lecky gibbered as he was once more wrenched to his feet. Hengist groaned with despair. And then they saw them coming. There were two of them, coming closer, pacing the plane one after the other, looming against the sky. Archaeosaurs. They were like mottled grey and brown mountains with massive reptilian heads on the end of long, sinuous necks, the weight balanced by enormous rippling tails as long as the bodies themselves. This was the second time they had seen such monsters. The first time was when the beast had destroyed the Imperial Guard camp. Lehman Russ tanks had been unable to stop them. Basilisk artillery had been unable to stop them. They had trampled everything, moving surprisingly quickly on their eight sturdy legs, four on each side. Thicker than any tree trunk. Guardsman Lecky found it incredible, almost unimaginable, that there could be animals as huge as these. Either one of the beasts could have trampled the village to dust by merely strolling through it, but instead they halted far outside its bounds, heads swaying. Despite their size, they looked placid enough for the moment. Lecky knew that really massive animals would have to be plant-eaters, and there was no grass on this planet, only ferns and moss, endless fern forests and fern-covered plains. He could imagine the wide swathes the beasts would cut through such forests as they fed. With whoops and shouts, the villagers dragged Lecky and Hengist out of the village. Being sacrificed to the monsters would at least be quicker than the death suffered by many of his comrades, Lecky thought. They came nearer. Now men could be seen crawling over the vast bodies, as if on hillsides. The guardsmen could also see house-like structures erected on their backs, and, what seemed most weird, one such structure atop each massive head. The steadily flickering daylight of planet ABL-1034 gave the scene an unreal, disjointed appearance. Now, Guardsman Lecky could see how the tribesmen climbed onto the huge beasts. Rope ladders hung down from their sides and trailed over the ground. Lecky found himself at the foot of one. A tribesman mounted a rung, seized hold of Lecky by one arm and jerked him upwards. Helplessly, the young man was hauled up the ladder, soon forced to assist in the climb or fall, lethal distance to the ground below.
Leckie saw Colour Sergeant Hengist being dragged towards the second archaeosaur. Once the guardsman passed the point where the ropes fell away from the beast's hide, he saw how easy it was to move about on top of the archaeosaur. The immensely thick and tough hide was corrugated. On the lower slopes of the animal mountain, one could walk in these corrugations as though in a trough or trench. Scrambling over these, he and his captors came close to the gigantic spine, where the corrugation smoothed out somewhat, and it was like making one's way on the top of a heaving hill. Leckie now realised that the beast's hide was in fact armoured. Up here, it was like stepping on steel or adamantium. Tribesmen dotted the vast back. The Hetman had made his way here already. He bellowed and gestured. Leckie was propelled forward, towards the beast's head. Even facing certain death, Leckie found time for a touch of pure curiosity about what was to happen. Certainly, this was an unusual way to die, an adventure he would have enjoyed telling to his comrades of the first Iaxist, if there had been any way he could have survived it. The Archaeosaur's neck, though long, was not all that lengthy as compared with the huge body. It had, after all, only to reach ground level in order to feed, so it was little longer than the 8 comparatively stubby legs. Traversing it was like walking up a mountain trail, and there, set on top of the giant reptilian head, was a square hut or covered platform. It was open at the front and back, and 3 tribesmen squatted in it. Leckie got an odd feeling. It was like looking at a primitive version of the bridge of some fearsome war machine. Leckie was pushed through the hut and out the other side. In passing, he saw what at first he took to be a dozen bony spines projecting from the top of the archaeosaur's skull. But then he realised that they were rudely shaped stone spikes hammered into the animal's head. Before he could wonder what these were for, his fate was revealed to him. Forward of the hut, also mounted on the beast's head, not far behind the eyes, stood a timber X shape. Guardsman Leckie's captors fastened him to this, limbs spread, and left him there. Leckie could hear the beast's stertorous breathing. It sounded like nothing so much as the engine of a Lehman Russ tank. Turning his head, he was soon able to see Colour Sergeant Hengist spread-eagled on an identical X-beam before the eyes of the second war beast. So here, Guardsman Leckie was, a mascot, an emblem, a figurehead, and perhaps a taunt to the enemy. The Archaeosaurs were going into battle. Against another tribe? Or a third Imperial Guard expedition? From behind him came banging, clanking noises. The Imperial Guard officers who had faced these war beasts had been at a loss to know how the primitive tribesmen controlled them. Here was the answer, though. Leckie could not look around far enough to see it. The Stone Age people had lived on planet ABL-1034 for a long time, and they had learned much. The stone spikes had been driven through the Archaeosaur's skull to precise points within the tiny brain. By banging the spikes with his stone hammer and making them vibrate, the mahout could stimulate nerve centres at will. One spike, and the creature would advance. Another spike, and it would retreat. Others, and it would turn left, turn right, fly into a rage and attack. Another, and it would spew fire. The Hetman barked an order. The squatting mahout banged one spike, then another. The 2 archaeosaurs lumbered off, away from the village, towards the giant shining warriors.
"Here they come," said Princeps Garius, "ready to move out."
The bridge crewmen of the Lex et Annihilato took up their positions, pulling down the control sets to link with the metal sockets set into their skulls. As commander, only Garius himself was free of such an interface. Chief Engineer Morians was most encumbered. His head almost disappeared amid a nest of pipes, tubes and leads. It was his responsibility to keep contact with the whole internal machinery of the Warlord, to supervise its running crew, and to keep everything functioning, whatever the damage. Tactical Officer Veridins would actually guide the giant battle machine, moving it like his own body at Garius's orders, with a direct neural connection to the power bundles. The Chief Engineer was also effectively blind, seeing nothing outside. Garius, Morians, and Weapons Moderate Knifesmith had access to the Koning Hollows. Garius looked to the right, where the companion warlord Principo Non Tacticus stood, also gearing itself up to move. The Lex et Annihilato roared. Warlord Titans had the imprinted mental nature of a grizzly bear, a powerful, bad-tempered animal native to Terra, and this sometimes made them difficult to handle. The Principo Non Tactica also roared. At a word from Garrius, they took a gigantic step forward, carefully treading in the spaces cleared for them. A few steps more, and they were outside the camp, striding towards the horizon.
"There are only two of them," Garrius murmured. "I had expected more."
At first, it was difficult to estimate the size of the archaeosaurs as they loped onwards. It was the speed of their approach, perhaps, that made them seem not as large as they really were. Moving with a shuffling motion on their eight sturdy legs, they appeared to Garrius's eyes scarcely larger than Terran dinosaurs. He relaxed. This should take no more than moments, after which the natives were unlikely to have any stomach for further action. Garrius, as acting group commander, outranked Ephraim for the duration of the engagement. He spoke briefly into his communicator, issuing orders to his fellow princeps. Fiber bundles humming like swarms of angry hornets, leg shanks clanging, the twin titans strode out towards their primitive challengers. And then, Garrius caught his breath in surprise. The brief, blurred transmission from the destroyed second expedition had not prepared him for what he now saw. The archaeosaurs were enormous, bigger than he would have believed, remotely possible for any land animal, even taking the low gravity into account. The monster's head, when raised, reared even higher than the warlord's. This was not the only comparison between the two. Behind the titans, using them for protection like mice scurrying behind a man, came the Imperial Guard Force, tanks, mobile artillery, and infantry. It was the same on the other side, a ragged column of at least 1,000 nearly naked primitives, armed with spears and stone axes, trailed behind the archaeosaur, ready to take on whatever their battle beasts left behind. How did the creatures stand up? Their bones must be made of steel, he thought with incredulity, or adamantium. Still, they could not conceivably withstand the Titan's armament. He barked orders again. The warlords angled out to approach the archaeosaurs from their flanks and get an easier target. Then their huge legs pumped faster, propelling them almost at a run. By now, tactical officer and weapons moderate had almost become a single personality, joined by the grisly bear essence imprinted on the Lex et Annihilato. The shoulder cannon swiveled, aimed at the flank of one of the impossibly huge beasts, and opened up. A shattering noise echoed through the cranium of the Titan as a volley of shells went hurtling towards the defenseless target. Disbelievingly, Princeps Garrius watched as the entire volley bounced off the beast's armoured back. Some exploded in mid-air, others flew away and fell to the ground. The archaeosaurs, however, seemed unhurt by the explosions. It lumbered round to face the Titan with its smouldering yellow eyes. Now Garrius saw that what he had taken to be a fringe or crest on the creature's skull was actually an artificial structure in the form of a covered platform, and within it squatted men. Did these men manage to control the animal? If so, how? But there was something else. Set in front of the platform, an X-beam had been erected. To this, uniform torn and ragged, face covered in dirt, was a bound guardsman. Up to now, Garrius's feelings for the enemy, whom he had scarcely considered an enemy, so inferior were they, had been neutral. Now his heart filled with hatred. "Poor wretch," he muttered to himself. There was no way he could help the prisoner. He was sure to die along with the archaeosaur. He put him from his mind. He doubted that weapons moderati knivesmith's aim was good enough to hit the swaying head.
"Aim low," he ordered. "The belly will have less armour."
Again, the shoulder cannon roared with ferocious violence. This time, several shells struck home, creating a brief smokescreen. When it cleared, Garrius expected to see the smashed carcass of the archaeosaur lying on its side, twitching. He gaped with renewed astonishment to see the monster still standing. True, some of the shells had penetrated the hide and left deep gaping wounds, yet the archaeosaur was unshaken. It was as if it did not even feel the torn flesh and flowing blood. And it was still on the move, turning to face the Titan. Garrius was about to order another volley, but first he glanced towards Principo Non Tactica and momentarily froze. The second archaeosaur, also dripping blood from a cannon volley, was charging towards the warlord at a run. Suddenly, its jaws gaped wide, and from between its rows of teeth came a white-hot gout of fire, which enveloped the upper part of the Principo. To the astonished Princeps, it looked like a plasma weapon, something with which he had not thought to equip the warlords. Who would have thought to need it on a world like this? He did not know of the Archaeosaur's prodigious digestive system with its 23 stomachs, building up alkaline gases at high pressure, or of the unusual metabolism which mixed pure phosphorus into that alkaline. When the Archaeosaur belched, which it did when angry or when made to do so by a bang on the appropriate stone spike, the alkaline was squirted out and ignited by the phosphorus on contact with the air. Evolution had devised the phenomenon as a defence against predators. Now it was even more effective as a weapon. The Principo's bridge must have been completely blinded during the discharge, though the void shields would have protected the crew from the heat. But there was a second tactic to the Archaeosaur's attack. It reared up on its four hind legs. It now towered over the warlord. When Princeps Ephraim's view cleared, he saw the vast beast come crashing down on his land war machine in an attempt to topple it.
"Assist Principio!" Garius shouted. "All weapons!"
The Lex et Annihilato swiveled. Moderato Knifesmith let loose with both shoulder cannons and the belly lasgun. The Principo staggered back, its own belly lasgun also opening up, trying desperately to keep its footing against the monstrous weight of the angry beast. It probably would have succeeded, but the Archaeosaur had yet another trick. It turned aside, the vast tail swinging round and crashing into the body of the Titan, where the power source and main engines were located. The carapace buckled. Now a red stream obscured the view as Principo's two heavy lasguns bit into the beast and vaporized huge amounts of its blood. Through Garius's communicator came a faint voice, that of Ephraim's chief engineer.
"Void shields down."
Then, with utter horror, Princeps Garius saw the Principo Non Tactica fall, first losing its balance, unable to correct the momentum imparted by the Archaeosaur's tail, then 1 foot lifting off the ground. Then the huge structure descended with slow majesty in the low gravity, until it smashed into the hard earth. Once a Titan was toppled, there was virtually no chance of getting it to its feet again. Princeps Garius shrieked orders, turning his attention back to the Archaeosaur threatening the Annihilato.
"The head! Aim for the head!"
Alert to the fate that had overtaken the sister Titan, Veridens backed away, jinking aside to prevent the creature mounting a similar assault, even though it was clear by now that the Archaeosaurs were more agile than their bulk gave them any right to be. Shoulder cannon barked, and both missed the waving head as it turned on its sinuous neck to follow the warlord. Garius was dimly aware of the other Archaeosaur trampling the fallen Principo Non Tactica, rending and splitting the defenceless carapace. Briefly, the lasgun hissed out again, but it was unable to target the beast. Then Garius glimpsed a final indignity. Men were spilling out of the cracks in the casing like maggots from a festering body, and he could see what they were fleeing from, a blinding, white, ravening glow in the interior. The warlord's fission reactor was in meltdown, its fuel elements fused together by the force of the Archaeosaur's trampling. Now Garius knew what had happened to the Gargants. Now its business finished, the second Archaeosaur was coming to join its brother. It was frightening how the mountain of animal was still able to move with great chunks torn out of it by four repeated shoulder cannon and two heavy lasguns. It seemed the monster was unstoppable. The bones of the beast were even exposed, a lustrous grey in colour. Garius could well believe they were made of iron or even steel.
"Aim right, Moderate, aim right! Look out for the tail!"
The warning came too late. The tail lashed out swifter than the eye could follow and struck the Titan on one knee. The warlord juddered. A muffled battle report came from Chief Engineer Amorians.
"Left leg disabled!"
Despite himself, terror struck into Princeps Garius's soul. His Titan lost mobility. The two Archaeosaurs were bent on, toppling and trampling it.
"The brain!" he insisted. "We must go for the brain!"
Weapons Moderate Knifesmith did not need urging. He was still trying to target the head on which Guardsman Leckie was strapped like a sacrificial victim. It was easier as the beast came closer. With a feeling of desperation, he watched shell after shell bounce off the giant's skull. Was there any brain in it? Was it pure metal-laden bone through and through? Tactical Officer Veridin shifted the warlord's good leg, attempting as best he could to brace the Titan against the strain that was to come. Both archaeosaurs spewed streams of burning phosphorus actiline, temporarily blinding the bridge crew. When the white-hot fumes cleared, they faced the dreadful sight of two battle beasts rearing on their hind legs, blotting out the sky. Moderati Knifesman realized that everything now depended on him, and that it would all be over in the next few seconds. In an act of intense concentration, he divided his firepower. He aimed one shoulder cannon up at the lower jaw of the first archaeosaur. At the same time, he leveled the belly lasgun and the other shoulder cannon together at the same target, one of the deep wounds in the second grievously injured animal. The hiss and racket of weapons was brief. A single shell passed through the archaeosaur's jaw and entered the skull to explode within it and blast it to pieces. Meanwhile, both cannon shells and laser beam ate their way deep into the innards of the other beast, inflicting explosion after explosion at the center of the massive body. The enormous spine shattered. Both beasts fell, one soundlessly, one with mangled roars to lie writhing in its death throes. Lucky neither had fallen against the warlord. Princeps Garius breathed a sigh.
Well done, Niceman. He turned to the chief engineer. Morians, effect repairs immediately.
Muffled by the mask-like neural interface, Morians replied,
Yes, Princeps.
Imperial Guard units were already attacking the fleeing tribesmen, causing terrible carnage. Guardsman Osman Leckie, having fainted with terror, had died without feeling anything, and no one had heard the death scream of Colour Sergeant Hengist as he was carried falling to the ground. The fires in the village burned low that night. Women keened for their lost men, and children cried for their fathers and brothers. The new hetman spoke gravely.
We have acted with honour, he said. We sent only two defenders to fight two giant shining warriors. Now there is only one other course of action. We must use the whole herd.
But that is dishonour,
protested a young warrior, one of the few to survive.
When we fight another tribe, then there is honour, the hetman pronounced. Beast is pitted against beast. The vanquished grants the victor tribute of grazing tools and women, and offers battle the following year. Here there is no honour. The giant shining warriors from the sky have come to take our world. They must know they cannot.
The men pondered his words, and can find no fault with them. The flickering dawn had come. The repairs to Lex et Annihilato were complete when the herd came loping over the horizon. Princeps Garius stared aghast. He had assumed from yesterday's battle that the archaeosaurs were rare, yet here were 100 animals at least, and they were running straight for the Imperial Guard camp. He looked stony-faced at Knifesmen, Viridians and Morians. Stricken, they glared back at him. Using the coning magnifier, he saw that the onrushing animals were bare of artificial structures. They were not under anyone's direct control, except for 4 or 5 managed beasts at the back, and these were driving the others on. The herd was being stampeded. There was nothing for it but to go down fighting. No officer trained by the Collegio Titanicus could do anything else, and Garius clenched his fists.
Battle stations!
His order went unquestioned. All 3 bridge officers pulled down their interfaces. Klaxons sounded in the body of the Titan. The ground was shaking. An enormous pounding as though the planet was breaking up could be heard even here in the bridge. The warlord strode out to its doom. Lasgun zipping, shoulder cannon roaring until all magazines were empty. Not a single archaeosaur was downed, but the lasgun, powered by the fission reactor, kept firing until it was destroyed. When the warlord was caught in the onrush, the press of the creature's steely flesh was so hard that it could not even fall, but was instead ground between numerous immense bodies. By the time the herd had passed, the Lex et Annihilato was smashed to fragments. Only the cranium was still intact. 20 light-years distant, the destruction of the 3rd expedition to planet ABL-1034 was evaluated almost immediately. A visual account of the initial battle, in which one Titan was destroyed, had been retrieved. In the final hour, Colonel Kostos of the 5th Helvetian, showing great bravery, had managed to send a shaky record of the final dreadful events. The commission was broad-ranging. Imperial Guard tactical staff officers, accompanied by the obligatory commissar, Collegio Titanicus staff officers and a priest of the Adeptus Terra sat around a varnished teak table. They had watched the visual records, including the bridge logs from the Lex et Annihilato and the Principo Non Tactica. All had been shocked to see what a people who did not even know how to smelt metal could do.
"The planet cannot be abandoned," the Adeptus Terra dignitary pronounced. "It must be occupied, if only to deny it to others. What are the options?"
The Collegio Titanicus officer spoke sadly.
"We should not send more of our Titans against these monsters. We cannot afford such losses."
The Commissar, present as a representative of the Minotaurum, stirred.
"The cult of the Emperor has succeeded in worse places. We can take the long approach. Infiltrate trained missionaries into the local culture. Given time, they will create a religion favourable to the Imperium. We can then move in and take over a friendly population."
"No, we cannot risk it."
The cry had come from the Collegio Titanicus officer. His face was pained.
"Don't you see? The Archaeosaurs are a direct danger to us. Our Dark Age Titans constantly decrease in number, even though slowly. None that are vanquished can be replaced. But these Archaeosaurs are animals. They breed. If they get loose into the galaxy, they can be bred without limit. What if the orcs get hold of them?"
It must have been hard for a senior officer of the Adeptus Titanicus to speak so. His voice was anguished.
"With respect, the Commissar's plan will take too long to execute. Meantime, there is always the risk of an alien race, such as the orcs, stepping in, learning from the natives and eventually deploying these beasts against us."
"We can do the same,"
the Commissar pointed out smoothly. The suggestion that Archaeosaurs might supplant the Adeptus Titanicus plainly horrified the Collegio officer. He shook his head vigorously.
"It is far too dangerous. There is only one real option. Exterminate us. Deny us use of the planet too, for centuries to come," the Commissar said. "I advocate the gentler course."
They pondered. And then, a shivering stillness seemed to come upon them. It was as though a ghostly presence had passed through the assembly. Several of those present looked up, softly murmuring the same word.
"Exterminate us."
Tightly bound to an X-beam far above the ground, on the swaying head of a giant beast, Princeps Garius raged with shame and frustration. Colonel Kostos had been right. Primitive people were not stupid. They were bright. How, by the Emperor, had they ever learned to bend the Archaeosaurs to their will? Could the Adeptus Mechanicus have done any better? Could it have done as well? Garius was forced to admit the natives' cleverness and courage, but they had destroyed his beloved Annihilato. They had humiliated the Adeptus Titanicus. For that, only hatred. Half a kilometre to his right, Weaponsmith Moderati Knifeman swayed atop a second battle beast. Tactical Officer Veridans was on a third beast to his left. Chief Engineer Morians was luckier. He had not survived the final fall of the Lex et Annihilato's cranium. Garius raised his face to the sky and cried out with all his soul, as though he could cast his cry through the warp.
"Exterminatus!" he pleaded. "Exterminatus!"
Thank you all for watching. I hope you've enjoyed this. It's a bit of a weird one. Some of the lore's a bit out, for instance, how Titans operate and stuff. But I think if you can forget that, it's an interesting little tale and another bit of 40k Star Trek, I suppose you'd call it. One, like these short stories often are. Nice little episodes in the grim dark. Please remember to like the video if you wouldn't mind, and share it if you think you've got somewhere where people would appreciate it. I'd really appreciate that if you could share it. Please remember to subscribe if you're not subscribed, and hit the bell so you get notified when I am doing these kind of things and any other stuff. More videos to come. Thank you for watching, and yeah, I genuinely hope you've enjoyed this. It was funny. It was good. I like this Barrett and Jed Bailey. I think we're all going to enjoy Eye of Terror when I finally get to read in that. But yeah, see you again soon. Thanks for watching. Cheers.